And we'll see how far we get. The idea was to come to the end of the path, and we can probably organize that so that we actually get there. But in the previous sutta, we have just seen that the idea, the purpose of Satipatthana is twofold. One is to abandon the very refined hindrances of the mind called upakilesa, and sometimes the five hindrances are called exactly that. They're called upakilesa sometimes. So this is the purpose of it, and then to take the mind to samadhi, yeah, as a consequence of that. That is what Satipatthana really is about. And then we have this next little sutta here called the Nun's Quarters, and this is a sutta where Venerable Ananda goes to the nuns and has a discussion with them or something, so it is one of those fairly rare suttas where the bhikkhunis are involved. It's not that common, but this is one of those. And this gives a slight different kind of side to Satipatthana. I thought it was kind of interesting to have a quick look at it. So let's have a quick look at this before we move on to the next one. What for? Yeah, so the four Satipatthanas, what for? It's when the mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware, mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. As they meditate observing an aspect on the body, based on the body there arises physical tension or mental sluggishness, or the mind is externally scattered. Yeah, so this is... These are kind of small upakilesas arising in the mind. Mental sluggishness is cetaso linatang or something like that, I think. Is that right? Yeah, okay, thank you. I can't even find it. It's in here somewhere. Okay, and then cittang bahidda vikippati. It means like you are slightly restless. Yeah, the mind is kind of going outside, and you lose your focus on the object that you're looking at. And physical tension here is kayasmang parilaho. Parilaho usually means like fever. So it's like some kind of fever or some kind of a problem in the body that arises. So these are all really defilements of the mind to some extent. Yeah. So while you're doing this, so what do you do when the defilement arises while you're doing this Satipatthana practice? And this is what you're supposed to do. That mendicants should direct their mind towards an inspiring foundation. Yeah, inspire the mind. As they do so, joy springs up. Being joyful, rapture springs up. When the mind is full of rapture, the body becomes tranquil. When the body is tranquil, one feels bliss. And when blissful, the mind becomes immersed in samadhi. Yeah, so you bring the mind back to samadhi. This is what it is saying here. Then they reflect, I have accomplished a goal for which I directed my mind. Let me now pull back. And they pull back, neither place the mind nor keep it connected. This is these terms are vitakka vichara. It's just an unusual translation. This is Aristotle's translation for these terms. So you neither vitakka nor do you vichara. And they understand, I'm neither placing the mind nor keeping connected. Mindful within myself, I'm happy. So the purpose of this is just to show you the interconnection between samadhi and Satipatthana. So very often you practice Satipatthana until it reaches samadhi. Then when you come out of samadhi, you may do some more contemplation, like we saw in the Anapanasati Sutta, contemplating impermanence and cessation, all these things. But as you do that, the mind may become defiled again, yeah? And then you go back into samadhi. So there is like an alteration between samadhi and Satipatthana practice in this way, kind of one leading to the other one, back and forth. And so as you always steady the mind using samadhi, and then based on that, then you gain some insight into the nature of reality, ultimately. But you may have to do it many times, again and again and again, for the results to come. But it's a very happy practice, yeah? As it says here, you know I'm happy. That's what it says in there. And of course, when the Buddha says, I'm happy, it means really, really, really happy. Yeah, kind of out of this world happy. So the Buddha understated as usual. This is kind of one of the nice things about the Buddha. And then you have exactly the same thing for the Vedana, the feelings, and for the mind state, and also for principles. Exactly the same method applies. You gain some defilement, and then after defilement has arisen, you use one of these techniques for inspiring the mind. What are those techniques for inspiring the mind? By the way, I didn't actually say anything about that. And these are the techniques that when you go back to the Mahanama Sutta, we had a look at on Friday, I think it was. What was that? Mahanama Sutta? Yeah? Anguttara 6, number 10. And that Mahanama Sutta talks about the various ways of giving joy to the mind. Yeah, recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, Sila, and Chaga, and these kind of things. This is how you then inspire yourself. You use an inspiring object. Or maybe you do metta or something like that. Anything that gives rise to the sequence of joy again. So that is how these things are done. And you can see how you use different meditation objects to then guide the mind in the right direction. So this is the Nuns' Quarters Sutta. And now I have added the Satipatthana Sutta in here. Really, it takes a long time to go through that whole sutta, but we'll just go through it fairly superficially and look at some of the main points of the Satipatthana Sutta to just to gain a little bit awareness of how it actually works. So this is on page 92, the applications of mindfulness. So, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kammasadhamma. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four applications of mindfulness." So in other words, this is the path that leads you all the way to awakening here, if you do it properly here. Direct path they have here, this is the Pali word is ekayana maggo, and the exact meaning of that is disputed. Adansudato translates it as the path that leads to one. Yeah, in other words, it leads to samadhi. That's kind of his translation of that. Path to convergence is his translation. So that of course is exactly what Satipatthana does. It leads to samadhi. So I think that is a possible translation. He makes a big argument for it in one of the books that he has written about this subject. Anyway, I'm not going to spend too much time on that. So again, these four, what are the four? And here I have chosen for some reason, I don't know why, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi Nyanamoli translation, so it has some strange terminology, but this is what it is like again. What are the four? Here a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body, yeah, body as a body, an aspect of the body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, ardent being like energy, fully aware being sampajano, and mindful, in other words, you have mindfulness established before you get to the Satipatthana practice. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world, in other words, having put away aversion and desire for the world, or liking and disliking for the world, referring to the world of the five senses, which is pretty much the only world that most people know about, because we are so immersed in it. This is also an example of immersion, being immersed in the five senses. And then you do the same thing for feelings, for mind states and for mind objects. You are each one of these, an aspect of each one, and the same kind of adjectives apply to this. So that is the standard formula for Satipatthana practice, and some of the most important information about Satipatthana is found right there, because it tells you about the requisite qualities that you have to be able to practice Satipatthana. Yeah, and so for that reason, it is very useful. So it is the background information you need to have success in breath meditation or any kind of Satipatthana meditation. So There is quite a large number of various exercises that you can do in Satipatthana. Now we're talking about the Satipatthana of the body. And if you know the Satipatthana Sutta, it has breath meditation in there. It has the postures of the body in there. It has the four elements. It has cemetery contemplations, 31 parts of the body. Yeah? 31 or 32? 31? 32? Who says 32? Who says 31? this is interesting, yeah? Because... The Sutta is 31. The Sutta Magga is 32. So this is always interesting because I usually say, kind of casually, 31 parts of the body. And usually someone corrects me and says, no, it's 32 parts of the body. Yeah. It's interesting because what it shows you is that where people usually get their information from. Because 32 is actually a commentarial idea, 31 is a sutta idea. So straight away it shows you how dependent we are on the commentaries for our interpretation of the suttas. Most people are not aware that there is a difference between the suttas and the commentaries. And it's not that it matters, it doesn't matter whether it's 31 or 32 parts, it makes no difference, but the point rather is that we tend to rely on the commentaries for our understanding of the Dhamma, and that is what that kind of points out, which is kind of interesting here. So anyway, so this 31 parts of the body, this is, if there is any aspect of Kaya Nupassana, which is, if you want to say, the most original one that came from the Buddha, most likely, it is this 31 parts of the body. And there's a very interesting study that was written by Adan Sujata called The History of Mindfulness, where he looks at the Satipatthana Sutta and he compares it to all the versions of Satipatthana that exist. There are two versions in Chinese translation. There are various versions found in the various types of Abhidhamma. There's one Mahayana version of Satipatthana. And when you compare all of those and you kind of try to distill what is the common ground between them, then the 31 parts of the body is the most common ground between all of these various versions. The four elements is the next most common, but some of them are actually very uncommon, not really important, like the clear comprehension, for example, where you are aware of the daily activities, probably does not actually belong to the Satipatthana Sutta originally, which is very interesting because a lot of people make often it is made a lot of these kind of things that you're supposed to do Satipatthana during your daily activities, but actually Satipatthana is a profound thing. It is something you do when you sit down. It is something you do when your mind is very peaceful and still. It is not really possible to do Satipatthana properly, I would say, during daily activities. It is a very peaceful exercise supposed to be, and take you all the way to samadhi. So this makes kind of more sense to me. And of course, we already know that the mindfulness of breathing is Satipatthana. Yeah, we have shown that in the Anapanasati Sutta, where it says that it fulfills all the four Satipatthanas. All you have to do is watch your humble breath. And by watching your humble breath in the right way, all the four Satipatthanas are fulfilled based on that. So there's two ways then of practicing body contemplation in Satipatthana. One is the 31 parts of the body, and the other one is just watching your breath. These are really the two ways. You could add four elements, it's not going to hurt, because it is kind of fits in with the thing, but this is most likely the most original, based on that particular study. I cannot guarantee that Adan Sudrata has got everything right. Maybe he has made some mistakes in there, I don't know. So we should always be a little bit kind of circumspect, but it seems like a fairly good study that he has done, so I kind of take that as my guide until I have better information, at least. And this is how the Buddha recommends that we do the 31 parts of the body. Are you interested in doing 31 parts of the body? Maybe, maybe not. Okay, let's just read it for the sake of fun then, whether you want to do it or not. So this is how it's done. A bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kind of impurity thus. So the point here, this same body, in other words, refers to one's own body. This is kind of one of the important points. And from the sole of the feet Up and down from the top of the hair means everything, yeah, bounded by the skin. Everything that is there is included here. And then you, this is a bit like an exercise in imagination. You see the parts of the body. Head hair, body hair, nails, skin, teeth, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. So that is the way they divided up the body in ancient India into various parts. And of course, the point here is to be comprehensive and to kind of not to and to see the body for what it actually is like. Yeah, this is kind of the purpose of this. And why do we do this? And the reason why you do this is because as your mind starts to become peaceful, as you get rid of the most coarse defilements on the path, there will still often be little things that block you from entering samadhi. And one of the things that blocks us most from entering samadhi is often attachment to the body, including attachment to the five senses. So the purpose of this is to neutralize attachment to the body. Yeah, the purpose is not to get kind of fed up with the body so you commit suicide. That's not the purpose, even though that happened to some of those monks who took it too far. The purpose is just to neutralize the feeling so that the body fades into the background, and it enables us to move forward in our meditation practice. But as I mentioned before, I don't usually recommend this to most people because it often has a kind of negative, and it's kind of difficult to do. You can try if you want to see if it works, and some people say it works, but it's not normally something that I would recommend. If people are able to do a little bit of mindfulness of breathing, that's already wonderful, and it's going to be a kind of a good supplement on one's spiritual practice. But there it is. It's an exercise in imagination, knowing that this is what your body looks like. Yeah, under the skin, the body looks a bit like this. Take the skin off, the body is not as exciting anymore as it is when the skin is on. It all kind of changes quite dramatically if you look at this from a more realistic perspective, if you like. What is that old saying? Beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes all the way to the bottom. Is that? So this is kind of like that. So then you have the simile. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, you review the same body in exactly the similar kind of way. So the simile makes it clear. It's just about having a realistic perception of the body, not so much about creating an aversion to the body here. So that is that one in brief. Then we have this little paragraph called insight. Yeah, that's what the heading is. Says down there, it says insight. Where do you think that heading comes from? That heading insight. Do you think that is the word of the Buddha? Doesn't look like the word of the Buddha. Yeah, it's kind of a heading. The Buddha, presumably, he didn't speak with headings. It's kind of hard to speak with headings. So these are things that have been added to the sutta to make it more easy to understand. Yeah, so someone has added insight in there because they wanted to be helpful and they want to be kind to help us to know what is going on. The problem is that you are kind of, you have to rely on the person who does that, that actually they do the right thing. But sometimes it may not be the right thing. And the problem in this particular case is that insight, actually, it is not a very good title for this passage that comes afterwards. Because the purpose, as I pointed out many times already, and you have seen it quite clearly in the suttas so many times, the purpose of Satipatthana really is to bring the mind to samadhi. Yeah. So the purpose of this kind of contemplation of the body here is actually to reduce the defilements so that the mind can enter samadhi. So when we see something like this, especially because it is in parentheses, we need to be careful and realize this is probably been added, I don't know by whom, maybe by the translator, maybe by, I'm not sure who has added this, but it is very uncertain and where it comes from and what its background is. And This whole paragraph that comes after here, the most important part of this paragraph, is the first part where he abides, contemplating the body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. This is the most important part because it is the part that you see in all the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the rest of it, which is more kind of perhaps wisdom-based, is more uncertain. So that is the most important part. And if you see how that is used in the suttas, it's always used in connection with samadhi. Yeah, you do it internally, you achieve samadhi as a result of that. Externally, you attain samadhi as a result of that. So it is really, again, it just goes to show that this is largely a samadhi practice. Of course, when you look at the body in this way, you are getting clarity about the body. So it is also clear seeing at the same time. It is both vipassana and samatha, but together they move the mind towards samadhi, which is the ultimate purpose of satipatthana. So that little insight word there is that some of these things are actually can distort the message a little bit. Anyway, I'm not going to say more about that. I'm going to just pass over that one, and then we have the elements. Okay, let's just briefly go through it. A bhikkhu reviews this body, however it is placed, however disposed, by well of the elements. Thus, in this body there is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed the cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this same body by way of the elements. And the idea of this is simply to know that this body is no different from the external elements. It's exactly the same thing. Where does this body come from originally? It comes from the external elements. Yeah, it is built every time you eat, or especially when you are young, you build up the body grows. It really comes from the external world, and then the body is built up of that. And of course, when you die, these things go back again into the external world to feed the plants and what else is out there. So our body is no different from the external elements. So how can we attach too much to this body? And then when nature is ready, it will reclaim the body and kind of take it back again, because it doesn't really belong to us in a sense. We can't control it, and it will go back to nature once time is up, and it has to go back again. So it's a very simple contemplation, but it is also quite can be effective in overcoming some of the attachment to the body here. So that is the body contemplation. The main part is the 31 parts of the body, and the mindfulness of breathing is the most important part. I'll have a very quick look at the mindfulness of feelings, the Vedana Nupassana, which is the next one. How do you contemplate the aspects of feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling here. When feeling a painful feeling, you understand, I feel a painful feeling here. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand that. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling here. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling here. Etc., etc. When feeling a worldly or unworldly painful feeling, you understand that. When feeling a worldly or unworldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand that. So here it is basically about seeing the various kinds of feelings, and knowing about feelings. One of the important points here is the distinction between unworldly feelings on the one hand and worldly feelings on the other hand. Unworldly feelings are called niramisa sukha, and this means like spiritual feeling, if you like. And spiritual feelings, they are the feelings that you get when you practice the path in the right way, the joy and happiness that comes from practicing the path. Whereas the worldly feelings, the samisasuka, these are the feelings that you, happiness that you have in ordinary life, the happiness from the five senses, basically. And so right there, things like the jhanas, for example, they are specifically, niramisasuka is specifically defined as the jhanas in the suttas. So here, jhanas and samadhi is already included. And this is kind of interesting that you find samadhi and jhana, in a sense, being included in satipatthana practice. And again, it shows you how these things are very integrated. Initially, the purpose of satipatthana is to take you to samadhi, but in the broader context of things, samadhi is also included within satipatthana. Yeah, but why is that? Well, because part of the purpose of satipatthana is to lead to insight, and to be able to lead to full insight, it has to include the jhanas within its scope for insight. Yeah, so these things are again so closely related to each other. One leads to the other one, one is included in the other, and vice versa, and they have all this overlap as well. So this shows you that jhanas also fall within this particular scope, which is actually very important. The other important point from this passage is, well, how exactly do you practice this? Yeah, you understand feeling, but what does that mean? Does it mean I just kind of walk around in daily life and think, yeah, I got this feeling, got that feeling? And that is not very effective. It doesn't do very much to you. So the way that you do this, again, is that you practice the way it is explained in the suttas, which I think is then most likely to be the right way, is through anapanasati. In the second tetrad, the second four factors of anapanasati, they are then said to fulfill the vedana nupassana. Yeah? You fulfill this contemplation simply by watching the breath, and then having the feelings arise as you're watching the breath. That's all you have to do. And then this whole thing comes together, and it makes sense, and we understand what we have to do. And what is so great about that is that when you look at the Anapanasati Sutta and you look at the kind of feelings that you have to contemplate there, it is piti, it is sukha, it is the mental formation, which is this more piti sukha, and then it is the calming of the mental formation, which is the calming of piti and sukha. So it's all about happiness and bliss. The only feeling that you really need to contemplate, or you need to see, or you need to be aware of, are bliss and happiness. Yeah, you can. So all of these painful feelings here, they have more to do with the insight that you gain afterwards, but you don't actually need to contemplate them directly, according to this. It's kind of nice, isn't it? So forget about the pain, just enjoy, yeah? Go to the joy, go to the happiness, and that is really sufficient for fulfilling these things. So I did mention this already when we did the Anapanasati Sutta, but it's kind of nice to say it again. And then, so that is the contemplation of feelings. I'm going through this very brief now, not in much detail. It's more like a summary than anything else. And then, of course, the third of the satipatthanas is the contemplation of mind, yeah, the citta nupassana. And this is on page 95. And this goes as follows. How does one abide contemplating an aspect of mind? Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by desire as mind affected by desire. Mind unaffected by desire as mind unaffected by desire. A mind affected by ill will as a mind affected by ill will. A mind unaffected by ill will as a mind unaffected by ill will. He understands mind affected by delusion or confusion as affected by delusion, and the mind unaffected by delusion as unaffected by delusion. You understand the contracted mind as contracted, the distracted mind as distracted, the exalted mind as exalted, the unexalted mind as unexalted. You understand the surpassed mind or the supreme mind as supreme, and the unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed, the still mind as still, the unstilled mind as unstilled, and the liberated mind as liberated, and the unliberated mind as unliberated. So this is what you understand. And so what is all this about? And about, again, what it is about is knowing the qualities of mind that you have to overcome and the qualities of mind you have to develop. This is kind of the purpose of this. So you can see there you have both sides of the equation. You have the defilements of mind and then you have the purity of mind. And the defilements are what we need to overcome and the pure states are what we have to develop. And some of those pure states that are listed towards the very end there, like the stilled mind and the liberated mind, well, these again are jhana states or samadhi states. Yeah. So again, you see that the samadhi in this case too is actually included within satipatthana. When you look at satipatthana in its complete practice, it actually becomes part of that. So you find this overlap between the various aspects of the Buddhist path. So again, how do we practice this? And one way of looking at how to practice this is again to go back to the Anapanasati Sutta, and there it says that the way you practice this is basically again just by focusing on the mind, and the mind in this case may very well, probably quite likely, refers to the samadhi nimitta, yeah, whatever light you may have in the mind, and then developing that light until you go all the way into a jhana state. So this is kind of the working with the nimitta and then knowing these defilements based on your ability to work with that nimitta. And these defilements will be very weak at this stage, but you will be able to, because they're very weak, you will be able to see them in a way, because they are about to disappear, you get more clarity about what they are. So again, all you have to do is watch the breath. Yeah, you don't have to make it as simple as possible, because otherwise it is hard to know what is going on here in this kind of practice. So that is the development of the Chittanupassana. Then we have the last one, Dhamma Nupassana. And for the Dhamma Nupassana, there is two main Dhamma Nupassana. One is the contemplation of the five hindrances, and the other one is the contemplation of the seven factors of awakening. Yeah? And the way it is explained here is quite interesting, because it ties in with many of the other things that we have been looking at. So on the bottom of page 95 it says there, and how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating principles or aspects of principles or maybe mental objects? Here a bhikkhu abides contemplating a mind object or an aspect of mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. And how do you do that? Here, when there is sensual desire in you, you understand there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in you, you understand there is no sensual desire in me. And you also understand how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire. And how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire. And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So these are exactly the things that we have been talking about before. How you have to understand the defilement completely, fully, the various aspects of it, especially when it is absent. How it comes to be, what are the causes for these things to arise. And remember, we talked yesterday about the subhanimitta, yeah, the aspect of beauty in something. When you focus on the subhanimitta in the wrong way, that is when sensual desire arises. When you have ayonisomanasikara in respect to the subhanimitta, that's when these things arise. So we have already discussed this in a sense, so now I can just go over it fairly quickly. He understands how it comes to arise. He comes to understand how there is the abandoning of arisen sensual desire. That is by taking your attention away from that subhanimitta and starting to use yoniso-manasikara rather than ayoniso-manasikara. Wise attention or proper attention. In other words, you don't see that object as beautiful, but you remember the disadvantage or the problems in that object that you desire. and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned sensual desire. And this is when you practice samadhi, and eventually when you gain the stages of the path, and you become a stream entrant, and all of that. That is how it never arises again in the future. So this is all about understanding these things in detail, yeah? And this is what, when you are coming very close to samadhi and you want to abandon the very last hindrances, you have to understand them very carefully and in depth to be able to do that. And then you practice in a similar way with the other five, the other four hindrances. Yeah, so all five of them you understand in a similar kind of way, so that you have a full understanding of what is going on. And then you have the seven factors of awakening, and the same principle happens there. So maybe have a brief look at the first one on the bottom of page 96. A bhikkhu abides. How does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects? Here, there being a mindfulness awakening factor in him, the bhikkhu understands there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. And there being no mindfulness awakening factor in him, he understands there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor, and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor comes to fulfillment by development. Something has gone wrong there. So you, again, similar kind of thing. You understand the causality that works with these things, yeah? And often you see this simply through your own experience, because you know that you can see it just by watching your mind. You see how these things actually work out. So, that is then the seven factors of awakening. You learn how to deal with that, you learn how to establish mindfulness. We've been talking a lot about this, and then how all of those factors of awakening then rise through that process, which give rise to joy and all of that. So that is the Satipatthana Sutta in very briefly. Yeah, this usually it takes a long time to go through the Satipatthana Sutta, but I've given you a very brief version of it, just to kind of have a look at it and be able to go through it. So we haven't got much time left, but let us turn back to the very end of this whole thing. So if you go to page 124, page 124, we have the last part of the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And now we're coming towards the very end. We have just finished practicing Satipatthana, yeah? And so that means that we have abandoned all the defilements of the mind, all the hindrances, so we are now ready for the jhana states. And this is what happens next. Samma Samadhi, yeah? Good news. Now we are ready for the real big time. No more messing around. Okay, so he, by getting rid of these five hindrances, the defilements of the mind, and the weakening to intuitive wisdom. Oh, this is what kind of translation is this? This is a. Let me just find a better translation if possible, because this is going to be a lot of suffering for me otherwise. So, Vivacheva Kamehi, that's right. Okay, wow, this is really efficient. So, okay, so here we are. So this is now Ajahn Sujato's translation. They give up these five hindrances, corruptions of the heart that weaken wisdom. And this is what we saw before, how these hindrances weaken wisdom, how you cannot really see clearly as long as they're there because you are biased, you have vested interest in things, and so for that reason it's impossible for the mind to see clearly. So you give up all of that, and then, because you have given that up, then quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome or unskilled qualities, they enter and remain in the first absorption, which is rapture and bliss born of seclusion, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. So now this is the first jhana. Yeah? Now for the first time in your life you have tasted what real samadhi is like, the full unification of mind, the kind of the bliss of getting very close to awakening itself. This is what is happening here. And here Adasudato translates keeping place in the mind and keeping it connected. This is savitaka, savichara, and the idea is to get away from this idea of using it as thought and examination, which is the usual translation. But when you get to the jhanas, you're not thinking anymore. Thinking has disappeared long time ago. All that is left is a tiny bit of movement of the mind onto the object and away from it, and there is no thinking happening at this particular state. It is far too sublime, far too peaceful for thinking even to be possible. You can't think anymore. Sometimes when you can't think you get worried, but here actually you become so happy because you can't think. People say, oh, I can't think. Usually that's a bad thing, but actually here it's really good. And so you have the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, the vivekaja, piti, sukha is what you have at this point. So very profound peace, bliss and happiness. And then the Buddha says, this Brahmin is called the footprint of the realized one, and also what is used by the realized one, and also what is marked by the realized one. Yeah, this is a footprint of the Tathagata, a footprint of the Buddha. And this is very powerful. Yeah, when you come into the jhanas, you know that something very, very powerful is going on. You know that the Buddha must have been here, because without going through the jhana, there's no way you can reach awakening. That's why you know the Buddha was here. This is the first time something is called the footprint of the Tathagata in the suttas. Nothing else on the path is called that. Only when you get to the first jhana is it called that. So you know, imagine going there, and you know now you're almost seeing the Buddha. You can see the footprint. If you keep on walking a little bit, you might see the Buddha himself. Yeah, keep on walking in those footprints, and eventually you will get there. This is the purpose of the simile. It's like the simile of the elephant. You follow after the elephant, and as you follow after the elephant, eventually you will see the elephant in the forest somewhere, because the footprints lead to the elephant, and here the footprints lead to the Buddha. Yeah, it's interesting. What does it mean to see the Buddha? And of course what it means to see, have that same insight as the Buddha had, the insight into non-self, the realization of the Four Noble Truths and all of these things. That is what it really refers to. And when you have that same insight, then you know what the Buddha was like, because you have exactly the same experience that the Buddha had. That's what it means to see the Buddha. The Buddha is just these qualities of the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha really is. Of course, he is a human being, but that is kind of irrelevant. What is relevant, what makes the Buddha different, is that he has this kind of insight. So the Buddha is like a walking Dhamma. Yeah, it's like this kind of walking emanation of Dhamma principles. And this is what kind of makes the Buddha special. So this is what is happening here. The first jhana is a footprint of the Tathagata. Tathagata Pada is what it is called. And of course, that's only the first jhana. Then you keep on practicing. You use the same thing for the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. All of these things are mentioned here. Yeah, and then, having come out of all of those jhanas, then you start to look at insight. And the first thing when it comes to insight is the recollection of past lives. So recall your past lives, which is also mentioned here. And you remember the past lives and a long way back, eons of past life according to the standard passage. And of course the point of remembering your past life is to get an understanding of dukkha. Because when you see the kind of the long sequence of life into the past, and you see how you've been roaming around samsara without direction, without purpose, now going here, now going there, without any kind of real meaning, you kind of get a sense of aversion towards all that, and you're ready to get off the wheel altogether. You're finished with all of that. Now we're getting into the real kind of profound Dhamma elements. So this is what the Dhamma ultimately is about. And this is again why it is so useful to see your past lives. And then when you have seen that, this is another footprint of the Tathagata. The next thing that you see the workings of karma. You see how the mechanism that lies behind rebirth. Why is it that you get reborn here and there? It is because of this impersonal mechanism called karma that then drives you this way and that way. You live in a bad way. Let's see what the Adasudata, how he translates this. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it towards the knowledge of the death and rebirth of sentient beings. That's a nice one. Chut upapatta is death and rebirth with clairvoyance. Clairvoyance is how he translates the Dibbena Chakrana. It literally means something like the heavenly eye or the divine eye, but clairvoyance is really nice. It is purified and surpasses the human. They understand how sentient beings are reborn according to their deeds. Okay, he has left out a large part of the Pali there. He has forgotten to put little dots, should be little dots in there to show that he has left it out. Must be a mistake in his. And then it shows you how you do, how that happens, because all of those beings, if you live badly, then you go to a bad destination. If you live well, you go to a good destination. And you see that directly. And there's a nice simile to show it to her. And then we come towards the very, very end of the path. We have understood rebirth. You've seen the problem in samsara. And now what you're the very last thing to do is to understand the Four Noble Truths. So then this goes as follows. When the mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it towards the knowledge of the ending of the defilements, the asavas. They truly understand this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. In other words, you understand where happiness is to be found. You understand where suffering is to be found. You understand how to get that happiness, what you have to do to become happy in the world. And if you don't take that path to happiness, well, what's going to happen is you're going to suffer instead. That's what you understand. Yeah, this is the insight of the noble ones, an insight into the reality of happiness and suffering here. And they understand these are the defilements. This is the origin of the defilements. This is the cessation of the defilements, the asavas. And this is the practice that lead to the cessation of the defilements. This Brahmin too is called the footprint of the realized one, and also what is used by the realized one, and also what is marked by the realized one. And at this point, you are at the very least a stream enterer. And because you are a stream enterer, then you continue that practice until eventually you become an arahant. And when you become an arahant, then you understand when they are freed, they know that they are freed. They understand rebirth is ended. The spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done. There is no return to any state of existence. This too is called the footprint of the realized one, what is used by the realized one and marked by the realized one. And at this point, the noble disciple has come to the conclusion, the blessed one is a fully awakened Buddha. The teaching is well explained. The Sangha is practicing well. And it is at this point that the simile of the elephant footprint has been completed in detail. So then you know the Buddha is awakened because you have seen what the Buddha saw. You know the teaching is well explained because you know that the teaching comes from the enlightened mind. And you know that the Aryan Sangha, the noble Sangha, is practicing exactly that way, and they have attained the same states. So you understand what the Buddha is, the footprint of the Buddha, and all of these things come together in a nice way. And when this had been spoken, the Brahmin Janusoni, this is not even in the booklet, this is in addition to that, said to the Buddha, "Excellent Master Gautama, excellent." As if he were writing the overturned, revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark, so people with good eyes can see what's there. Master Gautama has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to Master Gautama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gautama remember me as a lay disciple who has gone for refuge for life. That what happens when you practice the path to the very end, this is what happens, and then you are liberated, you are free, you are chilled. And now, Sitibuto, you are the cool one. Yeah, this is actually one of the epithets in the suttas. And you have found the highest happiness that is possible to find, the highest peace, the highest ending of all suffering. There's no more problems in the whole world. You have discovered the meaning of life. This is what you have discovered at this point. And there's nothing more to be done. Now you can teach others the same path. And eventually you will die. And when you die, that is the final liberation for the arahant and the freed one. And this is what the Buddhist path is all about. So, there you are. That is the... these teachings, and the whole path has been is part of that. And one of the things to remember about this is that to really understand what the ending of suffering is like on the Buddhist path is quite hard to comprehend. You can read this, and it may still feel a little bit alien. It probably does feel a little bit alien because it's kind of so different from our ordinary experience. So very often what you have to do, because it feels a little bit alien, is you have to take baby steps. So you start out, you do a little bit, and you know it feels right. Yeah. And as you do so, gradually you gain a kind of a feeling for what this is all about. And then when you sit down in a meditation, and things become peaceful, things become calmed down, things start to cease a little bit, yeah? Your thinking mind is a little bit less active, the body fades into the background, you start to get an idea of what this whole thing with cessation is all about. Things ending, things kind of disappearing from view. And you start to understand that cessation and extinguishment, things nibbanaing, actually is a very beautiful thing. And once you see that from your personal experience, you can extrapolate this, and then you start to get a lot of confidence in these teachings as a consequence. So if it all does seem, if some of it seems a little bit alien, you can probably kind of grasp up to the jhanas at least, how you can gain enormous bliss simply by stilling the mind and unifying it in a state of deep samadhi. You probably get that far. But then when it comes to the insights beyond that, it starts to become a little bit nebulous perhaps. But the ideas are there. You can already see some of this in your meditation practice. So take it gradually and see how you go. And then one day, something major might happen, yeah? And you think, whoa, this is what it meant. Jeepers, I had no idea so much happiness was possible in this world. It's just amazing how much happiness is available here. And this is kind of one of those things that comes about as a consequence of this path. Anyway, it is now just about the right time to stop this session. So let's have another break. Do it maybe a little bit more meditation afterwards or whatever. And then we can have some last Q&A and a bit of discussion or whatever you want towards the end. And if you then want to complain about this suttas, whatever, you please, that's a good time to complain at the very end. Because I'm leaving tomorrow, so I can kind of just run away if I have too many complaints. So